Chapter 3, My Intellectual Influences. My interest in monetary economics began quite early. Born in 1935, I remember the tail end of the Depression and the shortages of World War II. Being from a family that taught hard work, frugality, and savings as virtues, I knew early on that even a few pennies were not to be ignored. But then again, a copper penny actually had real value. I recall walking with my brothers to a local store to buy candy. We each had 4 or 5 pennies and got a small bag full of candy for them. Today, we not only can't afford to make our pennies out of copper, we can't even afford to make them out of zinc. The penny is destined to be made of steel or eliminated as a cost savings measure. Indeed, the penny is a nuisance for most of us today. My first job, and that of my brothers, was to assist my dad in a small dairy run out of our basement. Even at the age of 5, the incentive system was instilled in me. Our job was to make sure all the glass bottles, which had been hand-washed, were clean. It was bad for business if a customer saw a black spot in the bottom of a milk bottle. For each dirty bottle we found, as we removed them from the conveyor belt and placed them into a wooden case, we were rewarded a penny. It didn't take long for us to know when a certain uncle was washing the bottles, since more dirty bottles were found on those days. This experience taught me the importance of working and the value of a penny. My parents did not believe in allowances, but I was a natural saver, even in my early years. It seems at times that being a saver or a spender is an innate tendency, and early habits are retained throughout life. My early experience of learning the value of a penny served me well when it came time to pay for my education. My dad had 2 concerns about the milk itself. First, he tested for quality by tasting each can of milk coming in from any numerous farmers. He could tell if the cows had gotten into an onion patch, for example, which ruined the milk. The other was a concern that the milk might have been diluted by water. In time, I realized that the crime of dilution was identical to the crime of managing an elastic currency by the dilution principle. My dad was not a coin collector, but he did understand the value of hard work, savings, and even a penny. Somewhere along the way, out of fascination with a switch from the Indian head penny to the Lincoln head penny, he started throwing Indian heads into a coffee can, pennies that I'm sure came from our retail milk sales. At the time, a quart of milk cost 15 cents. I'm not sure of my exact age, but I probably became interested in coin collecting during World War II. I had access to the coins that came in through milk sales and early on as a newspaper boy for the Pittsburgh Press. That can of Indian heads sat on a desk in our kitchen for years. By the 1940s, the Indian head penny had long since left circulation. There were 986 pennies in the can, as I recall. I would scan them and sort them, and I knew exactly which pennies were there. Although it was obvious that I was the most interested of the 5 brothers in coin collecting, there was no way that those pennies would become mine because of the fairness doctrine of our parents. No special favors. I saved my money, and when I had $20, I negotiated a deal with my dad. $20 for 986 pennies. It was a big transaction for me, but only I knew that buried in that can was a 1909 S in good condition, which even then made the purchase a great deal. I still have that particular penny and most of the other 985. Pennies are a nuisance for most of us today, but that special 1909 S has kept up with inflation and more due to its numismatic value. As a young boy, I understand how rarity and quality in a coin gave it value, the fundamentals of numismatics. There were only 309,000 1909 S pennies minted. It was years before I understood the relationship between the money supply and the value of our currency and the business cycle. But even back then, I was impressed with the relationship of low mintage and value. During World War II, I heard the radio announcements urging us all to buy war bonds. We were encouraged at school to do the same, and I'm sure newspapers encouraged their purchase. It was the patriotic thing to do. I did it. My whole family did it as well. We would save $18.75 to buy a $25 war bond that matured in 10 years, earning 2.9% interest. It was only a stunt, as I found out many years later. Almost all the funding for the war came from taxes and the Fed's inflating of the currency. The Buy Bonds campaign was a psychological tool to keep everyone focused on the war. Wage and price controls and rationing made a bad situation worse. Yet it was our duty to march in lockstep with all the mandates and controls. From personal memory and historic records, I know the Depression was not ended by the beginning of the war, as many still claim. War's mass death and property confiscation and destruction are never a benefit to the economy. Yet the warning that bad economic times frequently led to war, when a country can least afford it, is appropriate for today. War distracts from economic problems, a benefit to bad politicians. Unemployment rates go down when millions are engaged in the war effort, even forced into it. All too often, these politically convenient wars are not at all necessary. I recall as an 8 or 9 year old wondering all about this while collecting coins, buying stamps, putting them in a book, then buying a bond and thinking it was a bit cumbersome. Why didn't they just print what they needed? I sought an answer from my oldest brother. Not realizing that's exactly what they were doing, my brother logically explained to me why that wouldn't work. He simply said, if they did that, the money wouldn't be worth anything. That may be way oversimplified, yet it was true. That short conversation stayed with me over the years as I tried to understand the process of currency inflation and how prices are subjectively established. Although the monetary system may be a crucial factor in itself, it is not the sole deciding factor in setting the prices of goods and services. It's a bit more complicated than that. It was only after the war and after price controls were removed, with a significant increase in the money supply, that more people knew what was going on. Prices escalated sharply between 1945 and 1947 at an annualized rate of 17%. I have memories of rationing during World War II. Ration stamps were required for crucial items like gasoline, butter, and meat. When we sold a pound of butter in our house, we had to also collect the ration stamps. These conditions existed along with wage and price controls, hardly a good lesson for young Americans trying to learn what freedom was. Without the designated rationing stamps passed out by the government, these selected goods were not available unless they were bought in the underground, free market. Prohibition or rationing was so detrimental that other markets quickly developed out of need. I'm sure some believe that rationing scarce resources during the war was absolutely necessary. Others were quite aware that it was part of the war propaganda to keep people focused on the political goal. Those who understood the free market knew that during a crisis or time of shortage, the market is required more than ever. And allocating scarce resources, imposing wage and price controls, is the last thing we need government to do. It only exacerbates the problem, as I well remember. We really never learned much from our mistakes. Wage and price controls were used again during the Korean War and in the early 1970s after the breakdown of the Bretton Woods Agreement. The unstable gold exchange standard system established in haste after World War II. I remember my dad as being straight-laced. He believed that we should all follow the rules and obey the government. Yet I do remember being with him on Saturday afternoons when a butcher shop in town had all the meat you wanted, at a price, and without ration stamps. Evidently, it was worth bending the rules a bit to get some meat on the table for his family. There seemed to be no secret about what was going on. Business was brisk, and the event took place across the street from the police station. This was probably my first real-life experience in the free market, solving problems generated by government mischief. Sadly, we haven't learned a whole lot. Even today, as we're struggling to get out of a gigantic economic crisis, the principle of government meddling in pricing goods and services persists. The worse the crisis gets, the more government interferes in the pricing mechanism. Today, the black market in labor and goods is huge. Our disastrous tax code has contributed substantially to the need for the underground economy. This need will surely grow as the economy further deteriorates. In economic terms, all this activity is beneficial in the underground, despite politicians' cries that the government is being cheated out of hundreds of billions of dollars in tax revenue. If the market quits functioning, the underground economy will expand exponentially. In some other countries, the underground market is responsible for keeping the economy afloat. After World War II, economic conditions improved. My grandparents lived nearby and had some land that they were contemplating selling. I recall my dad urging my grandmother to sell the land, but she was hesitant. She was concerned about the money. My grandfather was born in Germany and came to the United States at the age of 14 and settled in Pittsburgh. My grandmother was born in the United States, but her parents were both immigrants from Germany. In 1926, they sailed to Germany to visit relatives. I'm sure they heard stories about the German inflation of the 1920s, and this influenced her thinking. I remember the answer my grandmother gave my dad. She thought she should not sell and should hold on to the land in case the money goes bad. Although the U.S. inflation after World War II was mild compared to the German inflation of 1923, it must have been a concern for her. Shortly after the war, wage and price controls were removed and consumer prices advanced sharply, which also must have contributed to her concern. Retail prices were rising as a consequence of the inflation to finance the war. My grandmother was devout and knew the Bible. She had read Genesis chapter 47, verse 15. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed." Our current problem was well established, even in ancient Egypt. Debased currencies fail. Governments cannot manage money. Although the destruction of the dollar has been slow and insidious, deep concern existed even before President Nixon, in 1971, eliminated what remained of the gold standard. During the Korean War, inflation was a serious enough concern, just as it had been during the 1970s, to disguise it with wage and price controls. Today's politicians in Washington, oblivious as usual to the dangers of inflation, show no concern for the dollar or the operation of the Federal Reserve. They are, instead, terrified of deflation. Think of what the word deflation means. Defined as a declining money stock, deflation can actually be economically clarifying. It causes banks to tighten up their lending standards and encourages businesses to run tighter operations. It can put the squeeze on government as it becomes more costly to service the debt. None of these is a regrettable trend. Another definition of deflation concerns a falling price level. This is another way of saying that your money becomes more valuable over time. That is not something to regret either. Business can operate and thrive under these conditions. Look at the software and computer industry since the 1980s. And if we look back at the last quarter of the 19th century, increased purchasing power, deflation, was accompanied by the greatest period of economic growth in world history, with the benefits of capitalism spreading to all sectors of society. So I do not believe deflation is a threat. In fact, we would be lucky to face such a threat. The real threat we face is the opposite. The concern my grandmother expressed may have been overblown and early, but we as a nation are setting the stage for the money going bad, German style. We may be getting closer to that day than anybody realizes. The janitor at our grade school in Greentree, Pennsylvania, was an interesting character. He was seen as a bit of an old sage, at least by me. Others who attended the school will remember Willie, William Foley. He was the chief cook and bottle washer for the entire building. No assistants. That is, except in the summer months, when a few of us got jobs scrubbing walls and windows and painting. We were all 12 or 13 years old, and I'm sure child labor laws were never on anyone's mind. Our early wages were surely less than a dollar, since at that time, I also worked in a drugstore for 35 cents an hour. My experience in the drugstore paid off surprisingly well by the time I got to college, and secure the manager's job at the Bullet Hole, the coffee hangout for students at Gettysburg College. The experience working for Willie and listening to his philosophizing was stimulating. In a way, he probably taught me as much about life as any of my teachers. He could easily be a candidate for the most unforgettable character I have ever met. He talked about life struggles, but he also acted as a policeman of sorts. Though a mere janitor, he had some discipline authority, or at least bad behavior could easily be reported to higher authorities. But that's where he excelled, cautioning us, advising us, and mostly protecting us from stern discipline if certain events were to become known to the principal. The principal was a World War I veteran whose voice reflected exposure to poison gas in the fighting. He also believed in harsh corporal punishment, so most of us saw Willie as a trusted friend. I recall one subject on which Willie did a bit of ranting. The bankers were the source of our problems, and I heard the charge more than once. I had no idea what he was talking about, and for years afterward wondered about it. Unfortunately, I didn't know enough to quiz him, but as the years went by, I surmised a few things. Willie was old when he came to our school. It was a retirement job for him. He told stories of once being a glass blower and indicated that it was a high-paying job and allowed him to buy a fancy horse-drawn rig. Obviously, this was before automobiles. In thinking back, I decided he may well have been old enough to vote in 1896. Maybe he was influenced by William Jennings Bryan's populism and attacks on bankers. After many years, because I had never forgot the charge that the bankers caused all our economic and political problems, I decided he was a product of the populist progressive era of the late 1800s and the early 1900s. Although William Jennings Bryan was hardly a champion of our cause, he was a fan of Andrew Jackson's and early on was an enemy of central banking. In his Cross of Gold speech, Bryan shouted, "What we need is our Andrew Jackson to stand as Jackson stood against the encroachments of organized wealth." Bryan credited Jackson with having destroyed the bank conspiracy and saved America. Bryan was no libertarian, but his attack on powerful banking interest should make us aware of the historical precedent for protests against these elites. Today's building coalition that is attacking current central banking operations might even be more radical. It is certainly more educated. So far, the leadership of the Republicans and the Democrats has resisted any attack on the Federal Reserve, but that will probably change as blame for our financial crisis can and should be laid squarely at the feet of the Fed. The money issue is once again becoming a key political issue. In an Economics 101 class at Gettysburg College, a bit of a revelation hit me when I discovered that most money was not money at all, but rather money substitutes. The economy thrives, I was told, on all of us circulating checkbook paper credits, kept on a log at the bank. In my sheltered life, I thought we worked for money, paid our bills in money, and when we had too much on hand, we saved it in a bank, and it earned interest. That's what I did with my pennies and quarters earned from lawn mowing and delivering papers and milk. But now, it was explained to me, the bank only had to have a fraction of the actual money on hand. I was told this facilitated economic growth through the concept of fractional reserve banking. It made me question, but surely not enough, the system the professor was now explaining to me. In a way, it seemed to be a pretty neat trick. My first reaction might have been something like Paul Bagala's startling discovery while serving in the Clinton administration regarding executive orders. Stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool. Bagala, of course, was ecstatic over the remarkable shortcut for passing laws by keeping the Congress from interfering with the legislative process. That's how those who benefit from inflation must feel about the Federal Reserve System. Kind of cool. The banks certainly enjoy the benefits of the current monetary system and the principle of fractional reserve banking. Just like Bagala, the recipients of the benefits that come from the fraudulent system of money are pleased with a shortcut to acquiring that money, even after their scheme to enrich themselves falls apart, as it inevitably does, their expectations remain the same. They claim they provide an invaluable public service and deserve continued support from the public treasury. But this time, it is happening more directly, through direct, taxpayer-supported bailouts. Once this principle is established, the line grows longer and nearly everyone demands assistance. The seeds of financial distrust were sown decades ago, as I discovered in a college class in the 1950s. The corrupt system lasted a long time, but now payback is upon us. In the 1960s, I discovered the writings of economists such as Ludwig von Mises, F.A. Hayek, Marianne Rothbard, and Hans F. Senholz. I gradually found the answers I had been searching for. Even for the experts, it literally took centuries to fully understand the nature of money and the business cycle. Unfortunately, those in charge of our government and banking system are still denying the truth regarding money that was discovered many decades ago. While I was serving in the U.S. Air Force and stationed at Kelly Air Force Base as a flight surgeon, my next-door neighbor, a fellow physician, taught me something practical about the system. He understood hard money and was also influenced by his Mormon faith, which taught him self-reliance and frugality. I found out that on a regular basis, he was sending off and buying uncirculated silver dollars. At the time, silver was still under $1.21 an ounce, and therefore the incentive to buy and melt silver dollars for their silver content did not exist. But he did, however, pay a premium over the normal value. Although the added cost was very small, it seemed a little strange to me that somebody would pay $1.05 for a silver dollar that could be obtained at the bank or $1 for routine purchases. The 5% extra was the cost for getting an uncirculated coin. My friend's instincts were right about stocking up on silver dollars. It was not too many years later, in 1965, that silver was removed from the coinage. Even LBJ's claim that he would mint so many Kennedy half dollars that the market would become saturated and force the coins to stay in circulation was wrong. He didn't understand Gresham's law, that money overvalued by the government will drive out money that is undervalued by the government. And the more he minted, which turned out to be a record number, the faster they were removed from circulation. Since silver never dropped below $1.21 an ounce, the Kennedy silver half dollar never circulated to any degree. Another physician I knew during this time would periodically travel to Las Vegas and bring home a bag of silver dollars. These he got at face value. Silver dollars at the time were still being used in casino slot machines. Wouldn't that be fascinating to watch and listen to real silver dollars being used? Credit cards, dollar bills, and tokens, how boring. And I don't even gamble. The monetary event that prompted me to enter politics occurred on August 15, 1971. That Sunday evening, Richard, we are all Keynesians now, Nixon, announced the U.S. government would default on its pledge to deliver gold to any foreign government holding U.S. dollars at the rate of 1 ounce of gold for each $35. In addition, wage and price controls were put in place, along with a 10% import tariff. Instead of the markets collapsing, as I thought they should, the move was immediately praised by the Chamber of Commerce, and the stock market soared. Problems came a little bit later and lasted for a decade. The stock market rally quickly fizzled. This was the third broken promise by our government regarding gold backing to our dollar. Lincoln did it in the Civil War, and FDR did it in 1933 when he confiscated gold from the American people and made it illegal for American citizens to own gold. Roosevelt took the gold at $20 an ounce and promptly revalued it at $35. The citizens lost, the government profited. Profits from this process were used to initially fund the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is still in operation today. It is a slush fund, hidden from the scrutiny of the Congress, and has already used $50 billion in the current bailout process. It is a self-funding operation, earning enough interest from the Treasury to do at will what they want. Under the law, it is still permitted to meddle in the gold market, which I suspect it does. Tragically, the courts supported this illegal theft by Roosevelt from the people and ruled that all private and government promises to pay bondholders in gold were null and void. So much for Article 1, Section 10, which places responsibility on the federal government to protect contracts, not to deliberately break them. August 15, 1971, was a major event in the history of the American dollar. In many ways, it was saying the U.S. government was insolvent. It could not meet its monetary commitments. The worldwide run on the American system arrived, and the United States refused to pay. A fiat dollar reserve standard replaced the Bretton Woods pseudo-gold standard. There was nothing unexpected here. The failure of Bretton Woods was predicted early on by the Austrian economists, especially Henry Hazlitt, who was writing daily articles for the editorial page of the New York Times. Austrian school economists also knew, even in 1971, that the new paper standard would not provide stability to the financial system. The shift to a new monetary regime was an unprecedented experiment in global monetary planning, a wholesale plunge into the world of paper currency with no backing for the dollar at all. Americans became completely reliant on the Federal Reserve to manage our money and do so without any outside discipline. The chaos was dramatic. The dollar was sharply devalued, and price inflation became a major problem in the decade of the 1970s, as did steadily rising interest rates. But what impressed me most was that the Austrian economists who made predictions a long time ago were proven correct. It was the consequences of this event in 1971 that prompted me to decide on a lark in late 1973 to run for Congress in 1974. Texas was still a Democratic state and had only three Republicans in a delegation of 24 congressmen. The district I was running in had never been held by a Republican. In 1974, it remained a Democratic district. My first victory didn't come until a special election in the spring of 1976. At the time, I was just anxious to have a forum in which to talk about monetary policy and its relationship to the inexorable growth of our federal government. I was as surprised as anyone that this effort to spread a message about monetary policy and freedom would lead to a career of sorts in politics. I was convinced that if one did not play the role of Santa Claus or errand boy for a district, it would be impossible to win a seat in the U.S. Congress. My wife Carol warned me at the time that running for Congress could be dangerous. You could end up winning. I dismissed her concern and didn't anticipate that I had a chance. I was pleasantly surprised. As significant as the events of the 1970s were, the financial chaos we are now witnessing is much more significant. The fact that the system was held together for longer than many Austrian economists expected only means that the financial bubble, the debt, the malinvestment, and the international imbalances would become that much greater. The market made every effort to correct monetary mistakes of these past 37 years. The Federal Reserve was able to minimize the corrections only to guarantee the current big one down the road. That, of course, means worldwide depression worse than the 1930s, unless we wake up rather quickly. Dangerous times are indeed with us, and we will be forced to devise a new monetary system just as we were required to do at the end of the Bretton Woods system. But there is no looking back, no return to the old 1944 agreement. Today, there is still wishful thinking, but the fiat dollar reserve standard that the world has blindly accepted for more than three decades is dying, and the financial structure is disintegrating. What do we decide to do now will affect the well-being of American citizens for decades to come. There is no returning to the fiat dollar standard that evolved after August 15, 1971. The 1970s were hectic, and establishment economists were mystified by a stagnant economy and rampant price inflation, prompting a new term to describe the conditions, stagflation. Being in Congress in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and serving on the House Banking Committee, I met and got to question several Reserve Board chairmen, Arthur Burns, William G. Miller, and Paul Volcker. Of the three, I had the most interaction with Volker. He was more personable and smarter than the others, including the most recent board chairman, Alan Greenspan, and Ben Bernanke. In my second tour of congressional duty starting in 1997, I had the opportunity to quiz them. In 1980, a major piece of banking legislation, the Monetary Control Act, was passed. Many considered it a prelude to the savings and loan crisis in that decade. I expressed my concern to Chairman Volcker at a hearing that reserve requirements could be lowered to zero and the Federal Reserve could buy any asset, including foreign debt. Volcker invited me to a private breakfast to dissuade me from my interpretation. Lou Rockwell, my chief of staff, went with me to the breakfast. Interestingly, we arrived early and were talking with Volcker's aide when Volcker arrived. Before acknowledging Lou or me, he quickly went to his aide and asked, "What's the price of gold?" At the time, the price of gold was soaring and there was deep concern about inflation and the dollar's value on the international exchange markets. I believe central bankers are always looking at the price of gold because they know what many of us know. In the long term, the best gauge to the soundness of a currency is the gold price. The fallacy is that they believe if the gold price can be held in check, even artificially, it conveys confidence in the currency and the banking system. Defying market forces that want a higher price for gold by artificial means can only work temporarily. The market, or the black market if necessary, will always set the real prices of everything. Eventually, artificially fixing the price of gold will break down. That's what happened in 1971. Dumping nearly 500 million ounces of gold at $35 an ounce in the 1960s never stopped the depreciation of the dollar. Still, central bankers were determined to keep a lid on the dollar price of gold. Volcker was called to the Fed to stop the inflation, and obviously he was intensely interested in the price of gold. The gold price was the crucial test for him, since by then, the Fed had long given up on pretending it could fix the gold price forever. That effort, of course, was abandoned in 1971 with the closing of the gold window. Volcker, as an assistant secretary of the Treasury in 1971, expressed great doubt about the wisdom of that particular move regarding gold. Casual conversation with Volcker as recently as 2008 confirmed these concerns, but he assured me that a gold standard was not the answer to today's problem. The breakfast went well, and he was quite cordial. This is not something Greenspan ever invited me to do, nor do I expect an invitation anytime soon to a private breakfast and discussion with Bernanke. At the end of the breakfast, Volcker finally agreed that my interpretation of the language was correct, but assured me he would never lower reserve requirements to that degree, or buy up worthless assets. His argument was that the Fed wanted this authority to have free rein in raising reserve requirements at will, as he indeed did with interest rates that broke the back of the raging inflation of the 1970s. As we were leaving, I said that although I didn't expect that he would use these extreme powers, who knew if in the future we might just have someone who would? That future is now here. The fact is that not only has this come to pass with Bernanke, but a great deal more authority has been usurped by the Fed, while Congress says little about it. The Fed today has ominous powers that Congress barely understands. There is essentially no oversight, no audit, and no control. And the Fed is protected by the Federal Reserve Act. That's why the Federal Reserve Chairman has no obligation to answer questions that relate to Federal Open Market Committee meetings and actions taken in collusion with other central banks. Trillions of dollars can be created and injected into the economy with no obligation by the Fed to reveal who benefits. Lawsuits and freedom of information demands will not shake this information loose. Arrogant is a mild word to describe the attitude of those who control our monetary system. When Bernanke was pressed to reveal further information about where the trillions of dollars were going from the Fed, the answer was quite clear. We think that's counterproductive, that is, to reveal this information. My first exposure to the Austrian School of Economics was through reading The Road to Serfdom by F.A. Hayek in the early 1960s. Hayek, in the middle of the financial chaos following the breakdown of Bretton Woods, won the Nobel Prize in 1974 for his work on the economics of the business cycle. He is well known today for his work on competing currencies developed in the market, along with the notion that a basket of commodities may suffice as reserves. The basket of currency idea was something I never had a great affinity for, but I always accepted the idea that if it was developed by a non-government entity, no fraud involved, and it worked, so be it. It certainly would be superior to government fiat money. Many years after reading The Road to Serfdom, I had the pleasure of hearing Hayek lecture in Washington around 1980. Following that meeting, we had a private dinner together and spent several hours visiting. This dinner, which I remember well, further solidified my interest and confidence in Austrian economics. Early on, I had heard Ludwig von Mises lecture at the University of Houston. This was probably in 1972, a year before his death. At that time, I was extremely busy with my medical practice, but saw a very small newspaper notice that Mises would be lecturing at the university on a weekday. I knew there was only one other physician in the town of Lake Jackson, Dr. Henry May, who would care about such an unusual event. I called him to see if he cared to travel the 50 miles to hear Mises. We rearranged our office schedules and made the trip. Mises, at the time, was elderly but sharp. His subject was socialism, and his lecture explained why socialism always fails due to the absence of a free market pricing structure for capital goods. He was on his last lecture tour of the United States, and Houston may well have been his last stop. Mises died on October 10, 1973, at 92 years of age. Not to our surprise, the university did not give him a prestigious reception. The lecture was held in a modest-sized classroom, and the place was overflowing. Popularizing Austrian economics at the time was in its very early stages, but it was obvious even then that there was a starvation for truth in economics. The early 1970s were truly hectic, and since gold prices were soaring and the dollar was dropping more and more, people were searching for solutions. Today, of course, the problems are so much worse, and the need for answers even more urgent. To say the least, my trip to Houston to hear Mises in person was an inspiration. I suspect that when the definitive history of the 20th century is written, Mises will be considered one of the greatest economists, if not the greatest, of the century. That recognition won't come soon, because those in charge of the economic catastrophe are in total denial as to how they, who are now trying to rescue the system, caused all the problems we face. The universities are still cluttered, as in Washington, with Keynesians and socialists who refuse to give the slightest credibility to eliminating the central bank and instituting sound money. But this is changing, and 50 years from now, if we aren't driven into some dark age by our refusal to reassert the principles of liberty, the Austrian economists, and in particular Mises, will receive their due respect. My interest in Austrian economics, and especially monetary policy, naturally directed my attention to the ongoing effort to legalize gold in America. Since Roosevelt's edict on April 5, 1933, Americans were prohibited from owning gold. Only about three countries in the 1970s prohibited their citizens from owning gold, one being the Soviet Union. Roosevelt, by executive order 6102 in 1933, confiscated all gold held by private citizens, with a few minor exceptions, such as numismatic coins, and levied severe penalties on those who disobeyed. The penalty was $10,000 and or 10 years in prison. In today's money, that's more like $400,000. It was a rather bold, arrogant move from which much harm has come. Today, as standard policy, Congress condones presidential executive orders, signing statements, judicial legislation, and agency regulations as all being permissible. Although it was a major event to confiscate gold, complaints were minimal. The The crisis atmosphere and the need for government to solve the economic crisis associated with the Depression squelched any complaints about the usurpation of power by FDR. Since our crisis today may well evolve into something greater than what we suffered in the 1930s, we could only imagine, in this post-9/11 atmosphere, how much authority will be wielded by the executive branch. The only question is, will the American people resist? And if so, when? At least the Roosevelt executive order was eventually reversed, not by a president who could have revoked the order, but finally by Congress responding to the pressure put on them by grassroots Americans. The system can work, and did, in January 1975, when Americans once again could own gold bullion coins. Much credit has to be given to the late Jim Blanchard for his National Committee to Legalize Gold, which published a newsletter strictly to lobby for gold legalization. Interestingly, and we were reminded of this during my presidential campaign, he had a biplane towing a banner over Nixon's 1973 inauguration parade saying, "Legalize gold, a freer America." Today, that plane might be shot down, but it was President Ford who permitted once again ownership of gold. The authorities feared this move because the gold price is the ultimate test of value of currency. Since the dumping of nearly 500 million ounces of gold in the 1960s didn't prevent the run on the dollar, the international authorities were determined to punish those speculators who were hoarding gold. The gold price was bid up from $35 an ounce to $195 between 1971 and 1975, with the anticipation that the price would move even higher with American citizens coming into the market. Since the anticipated price increase was already discounted, traders were willing to sell, which they did, and gold went down precipitously from $195 and eventually to $102 by August 30, 1976. But it was more than just an adjustment by the traders. A concerted U.S. Treasury and IMF effort to knock the price down by dumping tons of gold onto the market served to put more pressure on the price decline. But obviously, it didn't last, and gold resumed its upward movement. Even today, the government and central banks have an intense interest in not allowing the gold price to send a no-confidence signal to the world of just how weak the dollar is. Central banks in recent years have been selling constantly, and I'm strongly suspicious that the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, the Plunge Protection Team, participates in the gold market as well to keep the price suppressed. As recently as November 2008, Bernanke admitted to me in a Financial Services Committee hearing that the only time gold is discussed with other central bankers is for the purpose of selling, never to consider its merit in serving as a reserve for a new currency agreement. Before gold became legal to own in 1975, many gold bugs were buying it. I purchased my first gold shortly after the breakdown of the Bretton Woods Agreement. The law was circumvented by buying numismatic coins. Any coin dated 1947 or older was considered a numismatic coin. Mexico accommodated American citizens by minting the beautiful Mexican 50 peso, weighing 1.2 ounces, and placing the date 1947 on it. The coins I bought at that time for financial security I still have. And now they are getting close to being legitimate numismatic coins. Jim Blanchard almost single-handedly led the successful effort to legalize gold ownership. He held his first gold conference in 1974 in New Orleans, and I attended this conference. A small crowd of a few hundred was expected, but a much larger crowd of more than 700 showed up. It was there I met Hans Senholz, one of the speakers. Senholz was one of only five individuals who received a Ph.D. under Mises. I got to know Senholz over the years, attending events in Grove City where he was the chairman of the economics department. He even came for a campaign event for me in 1974, which I recall was totally perplexing to my campaign manager, who was not exactly into gold and the Federal Reserve. When Senholz was president of the Foundation of Economic Education, FEE, After retiring from Grove City College, he had me join the board, which prompted a few visits to FEE's headquarters in Irvington-on-Hudson, New York. In 1974, I had met and came to respect highly Leonard Reed, founder of FEE. He served the great purpose, following World War II, in keeping the freedom movement alive and encouraging many others to participate in this crucial endeavor. Leonard was much more interested in education than politics. Even so, once I was in Congress, he had me visit FEE on a couple of occasions. I'm sure he was pleased I was in Congress, but he understood, as I do, that education is the key to political change. I have no problem with those who say education is the most important thing, but eventually a theoretical philosophy has to be translated into political actions. And that's exactly what the founders did. Mises had something to say about this. The flowering of human society depends on two factors: the intellectual power of outstanding men to conceive sound social and economic theories, and the ability of these, or other men, to make these ideologies palatable to the majority. In my opinion, the political leaders must make the ideology acceptable to the people. Of course, the ideology of welfare and socialism is easier to sell, since it's based on the majority getting something for free. But when the people recognize that's only a temporary situation, they will become more open to the suggestion that freedom offers more once the bankruptcy of statism is acknowledged. Such a condition is becoming more apparent every day. Making an ideology palatable to the majority means the people must come to realize that their best interests are served by its acceptance. In the case of freedom, the consensus of the people must be that self-reliance, free markets, private property, sound money, and enforceable contracts are indispensable to prosperity, peace, and happiness. Central economic planning and false promises must be rejected. Some, on principle, will always reject the temptation to use government power to enhance their own position. Others will reject it when it's clear that the prosperity promised, based on lies, fraud, and force, can only be temporarily provided. Transfer of wealth through government force is self-limited. The appearance of wealth by borrowing and inflation always leads to heartache and suffering. An opportunity has arrived for our sound social and economic theories to be made available and acceptable to the majority. Of all the Austrian economic greats of the 20th century, I got to know Murray Rothbard the best. During my first tour of duty in Congress, 1976 to 1984, while Lou Rockwell, founder of the Mises Institute, was serving as my chief of staff, we contacted Murray and invited him to Washington in 1979 for a visit. On his first trip, as he watched our office in action, I recall him saying he was amazed that a member of Congress actually made a determined effort to understand the details of each piece of legislation in the context of the Constitution. I recall his surprise when he found out I had read his essay, Gold and Fluctuating Fiat Exchange Rates. From this early association, he and Lou Rockwell went on to participate in many projects, the most important one being the establishment of the Mises Institute. Murray was a good teacher, and I have frequently said that his book, America's Great Depression, was a real eye-opener for me, as was his classic, What Has Government Done to Our Money? Having been raised in a Republican home, I was taught to believe Hoover's failure was a result of non-cooperation by the Democrats in Congress. Murray thoroughly rebutted that notion with his explanation of how Hoover and FDR endorsed the same flawed policies of economic intervention, and both were responsible for prolonging the Depression, which was precipitated by the seriously flawed monetary policy of the Federal Reserve in the 1920s. If there's one book that the Washington establishment should read now, it's Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression. In this book, he demonstrates that it was the Fed that created the late 1920s boom that led to bust, and Hoover's interventions that prolonged the Great Depression. Murray, interestingly, was on my congressional staff during the time that the Gold Commission was meeting in 1981. Murray, along with businessman Bert Blumert and Lou Rockwell, influenced my decision to run as the Libertarian candidate for president in 1988. That project, like all political projects, was filled with frustrations and shortcomings. Nevertheless, we all considered it a worthwhile effort in building the case for liberty. Obviously, the reception for the message in 1988 was subdued compared to the enthusiastic reception we got in the 2008 race. Conditions have greatly changed, but the Republican versus the Libertarian approach was also a factor given monopoly control of the electoral process. Today, the field is much more fertile for our ideas. Many seeds have been planted over the past two decades, and the effort is now bearing fruit. Shortly before Murray died on January 7, 1995, I called him to tell him of my plans to run for Congress once again in the 1996 election. He was extremely excited and very encouraging. Unlike Leonard Reed, Murray loved politics, Republican or Libertarian, or whatever he found of interest at any particular time. He got into the minutiae of internecine activities that were beyond my interest. He always knew all the players and their perceived intentions and philosophical motivations. He played politics in the 1992 Republican primary in support of Pat Buchanan in a coalition of sorts. When Pat opposed the first war on Iraq and George H.W. Bush's tax increases. One thing I am certain of, if Murray could have been with us during the presidential primary in 2008, he would have had a lot to say about it and fun saying it. He would have been very excited. His natural tendency to be optimistic would have been enhanced. He would have loved every minute of it. He would have pushed the revolution, especially since he contributed so much to preparing for it. I can just imagine how enthralled he would have been to see college kids burning Federal Reserve notes. He would have led the chant we heard at so many rallies, "End the Fed! End the Fed!" Even after the presidential campaign, the momentum has generated an interest in a serious movement to expose the Fed for the purposes of ending it, and Murray would be pleased. His intellectual effort would have been vindicated. Ideas were being translated into a serious effort to bring about a major political and economic change. His books, and especially his smaller booklets designed for broader distribution on why the Fed must be ended and a 100% gold standard be required, have served us well, and they will continue to do so. His books, What Has Government Done to Our Money?, The Case for a 100% Gold Dollar, and The Case Against the Fed, have been invaluable assets in educating the general public. Murray told a lot of stories about his time in the Ayn Rand cult and his association with Greenspan. Greenspan did acknowledge to me in private conversation his acquaintance with Murray, but I think of the different outcomes. Both started as followers of Ayn Rand. Neither became an objectivist. Greenspan went the wrong way. Rothbard went the right way, always perfecting the truth regarding money and the Federal Reserve. Greenspan became a monetary tyrant who sowed the seeds of the greatest financial bubble in all of history. During this period of searching for the answers about money and Austrian economics, I also met Henry Hazlitt, who was a friend of Mises's, a board member of FEE, and a close associate of Leonard Reed's. Like so many others looking for answers, I read his famous Economics in One Lesson. Mr. Hazlitt, shortly after the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement, was signed, predicted it would not work, and he lived well past the time to see its breakdown in 1971. Like many Austrian economists, he lived to an old age, 98. He died in 1983. All his books, of which there are many, are worth reading. Hazlitt was instrumental in securing a position at New York University for Mises. He had befriended Mises on his arrival to the United States after Mises escaped from Europe as World War II erupted. Although he was for years known as a journalist for Newsweek, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, Hazlitt was in reality a philosopher and economist. His greatest compliment to me was after Leonard Reed's death in 1983. He called and asked if I might consider becoming president of FEE. Whether anyone else on the FEE board shared this thought, I don't know, but it was something I never seriously considered, simply because I had chosen a different educational path. Another interesting tidbit of history was that Henry Hazlitt introduced Ayn Rand to all the free market scholars in New York which included his close friends Leonard Reed and Mises. The period between the Depression and the end of Bretton Woods in 1971 was a time of much activity by many very smart libertarian and old right constitutionalists and non-interventionists. They lamented the destruction of the Republic, but their writings lay the foundation of the emerging freedom movement that became so energized during the Republican primary elections of 2008. And there were many others I read that kept the spirit of the Republic alive. Some were much more interested in monetary policies, while others talked about personal liberty and foreign policy, as well as economic liberty. Having read the books of John T. Flynn, Isabel Patterson, Rose Wilder Lane, Garrett Garrett, Ayn Rand, Richard Weaver, Albert J. Nock, H.L. Mencken, and Frank Chodorov, I was not only influenced, but convinced that a philosophy that embraced personal liberty, private property, and sound money was the only political philosophy worth championing. To understand the need for sound money and no central bank, one must fully understand the principles of liberty. There were also several members of Congress during this period who held their ground and voted in keeping with the Constitution. Dr. Smith of Ohio, Howard Buffett, and H.R. Gross. We all owe a great deal of gratitude to the men and women who did such a superb job of presenting the moral case for liberty and refuting all the monstrous lies, ignorance, and arrogance of those who spent their lives promoting authoritarianism, statism, and universal use of aggressive force. Although Ayn Rand never spoke kindly of libertarians, and I never contemplated becoming a supporter of objectivism as a total philosophy, I did read all her novels and received her objectivist newsletter essentially the whole time it was published. She challenged many of my beliefs that I had taken for granted and forced me to understand and defend them better. However, she never convinced me of her definition and application of altruism. Equating voluntary Christian charities with communism made no sense to me. But she also built up my excitement for championing freedom. I have in my library a copy of the original 1957 hardbound copy of her huge Atlas Shrugged. The price listed on the cover flap is $6.95. There's no doubt that she influenced a lot of people over the decades and forced them to reassess their premises, and most came away being more devoted to liberty.